following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
I am Curtis B. Wayne, architect, and your host here, Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. You found us through the genius of the internet, and we're happy to have you here on the 5th of June, 2011. In no particular order, I want to talk about sustainable materials, particularly. Lately, we've been talking about the fact of alternatives to exotic the tropical hardwoods. You know, those of you in the business, in the design world, in the construction world, what is very much in favor is this very nice chocolate-covered, colored, not chocolate-covered, chocolate-colored hardwood called Ipe, I-P-E, with a little accent grave over it. Ipe comes from the Amazon rainforest. Now, we know that any sort of lumbering down there in Brazil is problematic in the large scale of things for the planet, because that is the largest rainforest on this spaceship Earth. And we need those trees to be doing what they do with photosynthesis, processing carbon dioxide, making oxygen for us to breathe, tempering the climate. And that logging, even if it is sustainable, you know, those of you who are lay people, civilians, I like to say, may know of this thing called the FSC, the Forestry Stewardship Council. And in practice and in theory, the FSC label on a wood, and you can get IPE, that is FSC rated. It means that somebody has looked into the logging practices of the timbermen who are harvesting these trees, and that they're not doing clear cutting, they're doing selective cutting, which means that they go through the forest and they look for big, tall trees and just take those. They don't just mow down the entire forest, which is very bad because it leads to erosion and loss of forest land. It can take years and years and years before a forest comes back if you do that. So if it's an FSC certified lumber, the idea is that you're not contributing through purchasing this material to the wholesale destruction of forests. But in sustainability terms, here's a lovely timber which does not rot. It's very hard. You don't have to treat it with copper sulfate salts to defeat mildew, fungus, mold, all those zoospore little beasties that want to eat up wood, and they do a very good job. And they're part of the, mildew and mold and mushrooms and fungus are part of the natural balance of turning the brush that dies in a forest back into mulch, into earth, that other growing plants can feed on. But when it comes to the timber that we put into our decks, our boardwalks, our patios, or even our fence posts and our railings, we would like to have the wood stand up to the depredations of weather and climate without rotting. And to that end, traditionally we've used cedar, which has oils in it, which help to resist the action of molds, or ipé, or teak. Now, teak is on the hot list of do not buy, because many, many, many of the suppliers of teak in tropical areas are just clear-cutting forests. They'll take big teak trees, old teak trees, ancient trees. They'll take everything. Way back in the 20th century, we would use redwood. But the American loggers in the West clear-cut redwood forests. Or cypress, same deal. And the whole notion of just wiping out ancient cypress and redwood trees. You know, if you go to the redwood forests out there in California, they're magnificent. They're incredible. To turn that into boards that could be then turned into picnic benches or your patio is a kind of disheartening prospect. So we don't see all that much cypress. And certainly we hardly ever in the East here. And we're over here in New York, over on the right-hand coast of North America. We don't see redwood at all anymore. I suppose you could get it, but you're not going to see it in a lumber yard. You might see some cypress. But emerging, and a friend of the station, Gennaro Brooks Church, if you look back through some of our previous podcasts, you'll see that Gennaro's been out to the station a couple times. Gennaro put me on to black locust, which is a native North American tree. It was at one point transplanted into Northern Europe, but it's a North American tree. Black locust is a very old tree. It has the sort of many foliated, the little tiny leaves, the sort of almost Pleistocene age-looking leaves that you might see on ferns in a diorama. If you go to the American Museum of Natural History, you'd see, you know, the dinosaurs and all these ancient trees. Well, black locust is an ancient tree like that, and it grows like a weed here in the eastern mountains. So you can find black locust all over the Appalachians in Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, bordering the Delaware River in New Jersey, all the way up into southwestern New England. So it's truly a local product. But up until the last couple of years, it has been impossible to find it. But the good word has gotten out that black locust is inherently rot-resistant. Now, back in the early 19th century, we're talking pioneer days, not the original pioneer days of the 1700s and the 18th century, but, you know, the next wave, when there was the push of white civilization out into Indian lands, crossing the Appalachians, heading west across Pennsylvania into the Northwest Territory of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. You would find in the early 20th century old farm fencing, and the posts would still be standing. The split rails, and we think of Abe Lincoln, the rail splitter, while he was splitting wooden rails to fence in farmyards. But you'd find these old farm fences, and the posts would still be standing, and people did a little thinking, and they found that they were black locust. And so black locust has a sustainable wood because it grows so readily. It's very hard. It's harder than hickory. We have a sample in the office because we're thinking of using it for a rather large deck on the roof of a new condo renovation in the West Village. It's harder than hickory. It's beautiful wood. It's sort of a creamy, greenish color. It weathers to gray, just like cedar. And it's totally rot resistant. It doesn't need to be treated. Now, if you look at contract documents, that is to say working drawings, over the last 20 or 30 years, whenever you would see a deck or posts, there'd be this term pressure treated. What that means is that the wood is dried, and then under pressure and heat, copper sulfate or copper compounds, salts of copper, were forced into the fiber of the wood, into the cells of the wood. You could take a Douglas fir or a southern pine, and you could pressure treat it. And those copper substances in the wood then would be toxic to mold and fungus and mushrooms and other icky things like that. But that's all of the past. We don't want to do that anymore. We don't, as sustainable architects, we don't want to introduce into the built environment artificially created substances that have these toxic heavy metals. It's just simply not good practice. But yet, if you look throughout the hills of Westchester and New Jersey, look at the houses, the thousands and tens of thousands of houses that have been built that populate the hillside, and you look at their decks, they'll all be pressure treated. But there is a better way. I'd like to talk a little bit more about Black Locust as an alternative to the ticky-tacky of the last 40 or 50 years. Roll the next one, please, Jack.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes, and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university, where they are put in boxes, and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
That was Melvina Reynolds, a friend of Pete Seeger, same era. I love her Brooklyn accent. She grew up in California, but her parents were part of this, I think they were communists. But, you know, they weren't into the status quo of American life. They wanted to make things better, and Melvina wrote this wonderful, wonderful piece that makes us think about, at least those of us who are in architecture and construction, why are we doing what we're doing, and why are some of the results that we've been responsible for so bad? Yeah, look, my first job in architecture was at a firm. Fun bunch of guys. We were living la vida loca there. It was in Monmouth County. About 40 people. We worked hard, we play hard. We're about a mile from the beach. You could knock off and go to the beach there in Belmar if you wanted, so long as you came back and got your work done. But one of our big, I'm going to admit this, one of our big clients was this developer whose initials are K and B. And at that time, in order to make affordable housing product in South Jersey, in Ocean County, We're building houses slab on grade. That means there's no crawl space. We put up regular 2x4 studs. These days we'd use a 2x6 so that we had more space for insulation. I don't even think that these houses were insulated. Sheetrock on the inside. The outside had a cladding that was both sheathing, that is to say, ordinarily plywood, but in this case it was plywood with a self-finishing surface on it that went over the studs and in between the 4x8 sheets of this treated plywood, we'd put battens. So our job was to figure out something that involved battens, which is, for the lay people out there, a vertical strip that covers over the gap. And then we'd add other little ticky-tacky trim to it. And if it was what we would call a Tudor-style house, there'd be diagonals, so it would look like Wattle and Daub construction from the 1200s. And the windows, which were sliding aluminum windows, which are the cheapest possible windows you can buy, would have silk screen on them. Diamond pane, so that it, ye olde English pub sort of motif on your house. So I am guilty by association with the ticky-tacky that has populated the planet. I suppose by now all of those houses have had to have either been torn down or so severely renovated that you would never know their humble beginnings. And okay, on the one hand, it was cheap housing. On the other hand, it was crap. So, what has changed over the last 35 years? Well, trying not to do crap. Trying to find the balance between something that is going to last a while, which is why Black Locust, back to our previous theme, is very appealing because it's local lumber, it's a local tree. You can get them within 120 miles of New York. There are people who are now starting to saw them into logs. You can use that in exterior exposures, and you don't have to worry about it rotting because it's simply rot-resistant. But it's not so cheap. Well, initial first cost is not so cheap, but if you run that out over 50 years of not having to do any maintenance and not having to retreat it, I mean, yeah, you could make a deck out of white pine, but you'd have to treat it every year with some sort of oil-based topping that would seep down into the fiber of the wood and help it resist weather. With Black Locust, we don't need to do that. It's a wonderful thing. Now, other sustainable aspects of construction that we are looking at every day in this modern practice of good green architecture include traditional things like the use of brick, for example. Yeah, brick is mud. It's mud and aggregates. It's mushed all together and then it is fired in the old days, let's say in the 19th century and before that. Brick would be burned, that is to say, put into a really big oven and heated and tempered, the same way that we would make ceramics, not as high a temperature as, say, the clay pots that turn into the teacups that you have in your beautiful tea set, but in the similar sort of technological way. You take mud, you form it, you smooth it out, and you burn it. And you've got an impervious material that lasts for a long time. In historical times, way back, if you read Vitruvius, his books on architecture, and by the way, you can get Vitruvius in English translation. It's Strand Books. I'll give them a free plug there on Broadway, 12th Street, Manhattan. They've got Vitruvius. I've been reading Vitruvius again. In Roman times, they would make clay tiles and clay bricks pretty much by molding them out of mud and straw and, well, you know, biblically, Moses' people protested because the Egyptians made them have to make brick without straw. Straw was used as a binder in brick. Of course, you can't make decent brick without some sort of binder to hold it together. Well, so Pharaoh wanted Moses' people to make brick without any straw, and so they took a hike across the Red Sea. These days, we make brick with sand and other aggregates, and we burn it, and it's good for hundreds and hundreds of years. We've got brick structures here in North America that go right back to the very beginning of our, the founding of our current civilization, back to the early 1620s, up there in Massachusetts and down in Virginia. So that's good for 400 years, 500 years. So brick is a sustainable material, even though it takes a lot of energy on the front end to create this material. Over the life cycle of the building, material like that has got a great deal of sustainability. Lifetimes and lifetimes. Now, when it comes back then to the case of, say, using black locust, its cost as a first cost is up there with ipé. Ipé is harvested down there in South America. The people who harvest it are not paid the same kind of living wage that we would have here in America or in the Northeast. There's an aspect of its economic viability. But then it has to be shipped on very large container ships a very long way. And those container ships, although they are effective because they're on the seas and getting things around by water, is arguably the least ecologically damaging way to move material. Still in all, it came a long way, and it's not hiring local people. And in these times here, we can only hope at the end of the Great Depression version 2.0 that we can hire our neighbors and our cousins and their family to help produce the materials for whatever we have going in continuing to add to the built environment. So sustainability has a lot of different aspects to it. You might say, well, then what about concrete, since you've mentioned brick? Well, concrete is a tricky thing. It takes a lot of energy to mine the materials that go into Portland cement, which is a material much like ground-up limestone. Now, in way back to Vitruvius again, when they would make their pozzolan, we use that word in a different way now. We use pozzolan to mean volcanic ash or fly ash, which is a byproduct of burning coal, which is a byproduct of energy production. If you have a coal-burning electrical generating plant, you're going to end up with fly ash. We can use that in concrete. That's good. But the Portland cement takes a lot of energy. And that's the main binder in concrete. We've got Portland cement, sand, water, and aggregate. Those are the basic ingredients in making concrete. In Roman times, they would burn limestone, which would reduces it to lime, which is a whole other material, which we use in mortar that goes in between bricks. But they would burn that, and then they would rehydrate it with water, and then it would reassemble itself molecularly into something resembling the original stone, which is why concrete is a to be extrapolated, we might say that it's an artificial stone-like material. But concrete is not perfect all alone by itself. It needs maintenance. If you look at the concrete works of the interstate highway system, you'll see concrete bridges and concrete overpasses. And concrete, if it is not well done, it will have fine cracks in it. As a matter of fact, all concrete structures over time will crack. It's the nature of concrete to shrink as it cures, which creates cracks, which give an opportunity for water to get into the concrete. And because in modern times we make reinforced concrete using steel, that water will get in, it will attack the steel, and the steel will start to corrode. And then what you see, and you frequently see, all over, here, Europe, Asia, everywhere, you'll see concrete where it has spalled, which is to say it breaks off in fist-sized pieces, revealing the reinforcing steel, which is necessarily placed, usually depending on the loads that are carried, but usually placed towards the bottom of the concrete form so as to resist the tension forces that happen there. So concrete requires maintenance. So concrete is not as sustainable as, say, brick, which if it's properly mortared up and properly manufactured brick in the first place, it's going to be good for 50, 60 years before it needs any pointing work on its mortar. Or the older kinds of brick that we used in the 19th century, which were molded and extruded and made in very precise sizes, we could use much thinner, much softer mortar. And those buildings require repointing only every 120, 150 years. So in the scale of sustainability, if we can find wood materials like black locust, perhaps like cypress, although cypress trees take a long time to grow, whereas black locust grows very quickly. Not redwood. Redwood takes too long. That's very sustainable. That's a very sustainable material to use. Brick, although it takes a lot of energy on the front end to create, is good for hundreds of years. Concrete takes a lot of energy and it's not so sustainable. Steel, next up on the list, takes a lot of energy to refine. Interesting point. Something I was not aware of until just about a year or so ago. Most of the steel that we use these days in North America is 97% recycled content, which means that old car parts, worn out rails from our railroad system, axles from rail cars, any sort of steel material is scavenged, recycled. The impurities are burned out in basic oxygen furnaces. That's where they put the bits of steel in there. They put enormous amounts of electricity through an arc in there. It causes the steel to melt. It burns out the impurities, and then the chemists get to work, and they put back in the additives that make it strong and make it rust-resistant and whatever the quality of the steel that it is you want to create. So there's very little iron mining happening anywhere. You know, up there in Minnesota that used to have all the iron mines. Those of us who are older will remember the song about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, an ore ship that Gordon Lightfoot sang about. Well, we don't have ore ships like that anymore because we are recycling our steel. So that makes steel a very green material, because once it goes into a building, then that building is good for at least 200, 250 years, because once steel is embedded in a structure, it's good. It's good for a long time. Look at the steel and iron that's in the Eiffel Tower. That was built for the exposition in Paris in 1900. It's in fine condition. Of course, they've had to paint it. Still and all, steel and iron are very green as materials, even though they're not organic. They're entirely artificial of our, you know, humanity's attempts to control our environment. That's the end of my little chat for today. If Jackie, you would go to the very last cut, remember that life is a long song, and that's the story about sustainability. Let's give a long life to what we create. This has been Burning Down the House here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
When you're falling awake and you take stock of the new day, and you hear your voice croak as you choke on what you need to say, well, don't you fret, don't you fear, I will give you good cheer. Life's a long song. Life's a long song. Life's a long song. If you wait, then you play it. I will fail as the verses unfold.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Life's a long song. Life's a long song. We will meet in the sweet light of dawn as the Baker Street train spills your pain all over your new dress and the symphony sounds.
The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. A beef cut has been designed for a beer pairing. I know you're all going to be really happy to hear that. The Samuel Adams Boston Lager Cut will be available nationwide through an online retailer. This was actually designed by Jake Dixon of New York City's Dixon's Farm Stand Meats, located in the Chelsea Market, and it's cut from the cap to the top sirloin at a 45-degree angle. It's a nice-looking little steak. It's an 8-ounce steak that is designed to complement Sam Adams Boston Lager. But I bet you could find other beers that it would pair well with as well. So look out for it. Let's see what it's like. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Check out a small clip of Chef Smarty Pants, a.k.a. Erica Wides, talking about radishes on her show, Why We Cook.
Those supermarket radishes were like that. They were all heat and no flavor and woody and tough, and they were always kind of beat up and buggy looking, and they looked like crap. I don't understand why they were sold, and they were in that plastic bag all sealed up for like 6 months. Why buy them? We always put them into our salad growing up, and I would just pick them out. And my mom still buys them. She still buys those bags. To me, those bags of radishes are like the ultimate symbol of industrial produce. They're grown for size and for color, but they taste like balls of wood dipped in nail polish remover. I don't understand why people would eat them. So I never understood the appeal of the radish until...
Want to hear more? Tune in live to Why We Cook every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., or you can find all the old shows on our archives. Also, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening.